This week on Dana's Low Carb for Life, we talk about the most important nutrition book of the season and question reality. So stick around. You are listening to Dana's Low Carb for Life. Hey again. Welcome to episode 27 of Dana's Low Carb for Life. This show, I only have two segments instead of my customary three because the first one runs kind of long, but I thought it was important enough that I didn't want to cut it. I have gotten some feedback from listeners regarding low-carb lunchbox ideas, so I promise we're going to get to those next week. But this week, I want to tell you about the book I've just read, and I also want to talk about the nature of reality. But before I get to that, I should tell you that as I record this, it is Labor Day 2011. Yes, it is Monday, the actual day, Labor Day. And since I went low carb on the day after Labor Day 1995, the Tuesday after Labor Day, I actually had the idea a few days before that, but I had already planned a cookout with a whole bunch of people invited for Labor Day itself and had already cooked a bunch of food and whatever. So I confess, I put it off until the Tuesday. But anyway, I went low carb on the day after Labor Day 1995. So this makes this long weekend my official 16th anniversary of low carbing. Woohoo! Well, since I'm about to turn 53, I'll be 53 in October, this means that I have been low carb now for just over 30% of my life. Remember that the next time you hear or read someone say, oh, that diet is good for quick weight loss, but no one can eat that way long term. Folks, here I am. And quite honestly, I'm enjoying myself. I'm certainly enjoying myself more than I did when I had nasty blood sugar swings and energy dropouts and constant gnawing hunger. And I have to say that a ribeye steak and a glass of red wine beats a bowl of whole wheat pasta and fat-free sauce any day of the week. Okay, other seasonal reminder, this, and it's not a reminder because you didn't know this. This is more a mark your calendars alert. Our friend Jennifer Perry here in Bloomington, a couple of years ago declared her own holiday. Yes, the second Sunday in September is officially Beefmas. This is to be celebrated largely by feasting on beef. No, this is not an official holiday yet, but then neither was International Talk Like a Pirate Day, and yeah, look how that's caught on. So, remember, next Sunday is Beefmas. Whether it's steak or prime rib or burgers or short ribs, start planning your feast of beef now. Okay, let us move on. In a little while, I want to talk to you about what the word real means. But first, I want to let you in on the thing that has been obsessing me for the past week, has delayed the writing and recording of this podcast, and is changing my own personal version of a low-carb diet. Those of you who read the blog already know about this. Those of you who hang out on my Facebook fan page already know about this. So please bear with me because the folks who just listen to the podcast really need to hear this. Pardon me, that's my sharing a swallow of iced tea with you. I have read a big old pile of nutrition books over the last 33 years. And indeed, I am sitting here in my home office, which has built-in bookcases, and they are simply crammed with nutrition books. Everything from really recent stuff all the way back to I have one from 1914. I generally learn a little something from each one, a few things here and there. Although there is the occasional nutrition book that just makes me snort with derision. But, you know, usually I learn a little something, or at the very least I'm reminded of a point that I might have forgotten. But in his new book, Wheat Belly, which is just recently in the stores and at Amazon, Dr. William Davis, who is a cardiologist from Milwaukee, he is also the author of Track Your Plaque and of the Heart Scan blog, and he has long advocated a low-carbohydrate diet for cardiovascular health. Well, Dr. Davis has written this book, Wheat Belly, and the majority of the information in it is new to me. I am, quite frankly, agog. I am excited because I am, after all, a big old nutrition geek, and it's thrilling to have this sort of stuff presented to me, and I might add, presented in a really, really readable form. But I am also frightened. Why am I frightened? because the size of the problem Dr. Davis has limned in this groundbreaking new book is staggering in its scope and its implications. The stuff that is causing the problems is not only near universal, but widely seen as the most wholesome and beneficial of foods and is pushed at us from every corner. Well, ironically, I had it in my mind that I needed to review Wheat Belly when I got an email from a reader who told me she was just thrilled by my low-carb whole wheat bread recipe. I'm glad she likes the recipe, and I'm glad she finds my book useful, but I had to sigh. Of all the foods low-carbers give up, perhaps the group that is most acutely missed is stuff that's made from wheat, particularly bread and pasta, bagels, and things like that. New low-carbers especially are forever searching for a version of these foods that will allow them to have their sandwiches and their mac and cheese and all of that while maintaining the benefits of their low-carbohydrate diets. And every time some new low-carb bread hits the market, the Julian Bakeries, the Dreamfields pasta hits the market, everybody's all excited. Oh, look, I don't really have to give it up. For years, I kept low-carb bread from Natural Ovens of Manitowoc in my freezer, most of which, by the way, was consumed in the form of late-night grilled cheese sandwiches. And for a long time, low-carb tortillas were a staple in my house, particularly in the summer. I pretty commonly would eat low-carb wrap sandwiches for lunch, and they were absolutely de rigueur when we were on the road. We would take cold cuts and low-carb tortillas and make wraps in the car. And while I never quite trusted the Dreamfields pasta, I have repeatedly answered readers' plaintive inquiries as to whether it's okay or too good to be true. It's too good to be true. Sorry. Look at Dr. Andreas Enfeldt's write-up of that on his Diet Doctor blog. Well, accordingly, in several of my books, I have included yeast bread recipes. I have also fairly commonly used modest quantities of wheat germ and or wheat bran, which are, of course, the low starch fractions of the wheat kernel, to give a wheaty flavor to crackers, pancakes, you know, stuff like that. Two, for a while, I was adding a little vital wheat gluten, which is the protein portion of the wheat kernel, to various baked goods like cookies and stuff because it does make them hold together better. It improves their structural tenacity. And all these baked good recipes have proven to be very popular with my readers. And this all is very logical if you think about it, even inevitable. We have heard since childhood that bread is the very staff of life. Husbands pride themselves on being good breadwinners. We show friendship by breaking bread together. Religious ceremonies, most notably the Christian Eucharist, center on bread as a symbol. And every Christian sect has, of course, learned to ask God to give us this day our daily bread. And I might include here parenthetically the fact that I have heard it reported that the Inuit, the Eskimos, had no clue what bread was. And when missionaries got to the Inuit, they were stuck with teaching the Lord's Prayer to people who had never been interested in daily bread because they'd never seen bread. And apparently the Eskimo version of the Lord's Prayer goes, "Give us this day our daily fish." I believe this is an improvement. But again, bread is this very symbolic thing, right? And it's got this image of wholesomeness and stuff. It is perhaps possible for us to accept that we, with our damaged carbohydrate metabolisms, whether we're obese or have diabetes or PCOS or whatever, that we simply cannot tolerate most baked goods in the same way some people can't eat nuts or can't eat shellfish, that it's a personal sensitivity. It is a very different thing to accept that these seemingly ancient foods with so much inbuilt emotional and symbolic meaning are quite simply hazardous and even toxic. Still, awareness that gluten, again, that is the protein fraction of wheat, and it makes wheat the versatile stuff that it is, The idea that gluten may not be good for us has been growing rapidly, and the demand for gluten-free foods has been exploding. I looked up searches for gluten-free on Google. You can track how many people are searching for something, and good Lord, it's skyrocketed. The number of complaints, health problems that are now suspected of being tied to gluten consumption is increasingly daunting. But has this always been so? Are we just now noticing that this most common of foodstuffs is toxic? Is it sort of like the fish who swims in polluted water and doesn't even notice it's polluted? Or has something changed over the years? Well, both, it seems. In Wheat Belly, Dr. Davis identifies two major problems with the ubiquitous consumption of wheat products. One is the fact that wheat, whether it's in the form of cheesy, squishy white bread or sprouted 100% whole wheat bread from the health food store, spikes blood sugar like nobody's business. It's not just a major source of carbohydrate in the diet, it's also one of the most rapidly absorbed forms of carbohydrate. I'm going to assume that we can take it as read that big old carb loads and big blood sugar spikes are bad and that they lead to weight gain, which, of course, Dr. Davis is calling wheat belly, diabetes, high blood pressure, high triglycerides, messed up HDL-LDL ratios, messed up LDL particle size, all that other stuff that low carbers have been talking about for all these years. Lots of blood sugar, bad. Got it. It's the part about gluten that's really got my head spinning. I've known for 30 years or more that there was an illness called celiac or celiac's brew that was caused by gluten sensitivity and results in terrible intestinal trouble to the point where people with celiac disease often are badly malnourished because everything they eat goes right through them. I had become aware over the past few years that the list of health problems being attributed to gluten was rapidly expanding, and I knew that there was a suspicion that it was involved in or even to blame for a number of autoimmune diseases in particular. I'd heard that rheumatoid arthritis was linked to it and possibly even juvenile onset diabetes, which is kind of staggering to think about. I also know that I have some friends with an autistic child who functions far better on a gluten-free diet. Certainly, it would be impossible for anyone paying even a cursory amount of attention to the world of nutrition not to notice the growing ranks of people going gluten-free and, of course, the growing arrays of gluten-free foods that are designed to serve them. More iced tea here. I've also known, of course, for 16 years now, that owing to their carb load, grains, whether whole or refined grains, are simply not my friend. But I didn't connect the two. You know, some people were gluten sensitive, but I was carb sensitive. I'd never shown any signs of celiac. My guts work just fine, thank you, and I'm sure you wanted to know that. So gluten didn't seem to be a concern for me. I had no idea that the list of health problems now attributable to gluten was so long and so frightening. Among the health conditions Dr. Davis links to gluten are, well, let's start with the big casino, schizophrenia. Turns out that taking wheat products away from institutionalized schizophrenics reduced auditory hallucinations, delusions, all that stuff that makes schizophrenia the terrible, terrible illness that it is. Adding wheat back caused those symptoms to reassert themselves. There are even some reports of complete remission of schizophrenia with removal of wheat from the diet. I mentioned autism. Research on this is preliminary, and certainly officialdom is denying it left and right. No, no, no. Autism is not linked to gluten. But there is a Danish study of 55 autistic children. That's a small study. But they found that removing gluten from the diet did reduce formal measures of autistic behavior. There are also many parents who simply say, yeah, taking gluten away from the kid makes the autism better. Liver diseases, including chronic hepatitis and biliary cancer, that would be cancer of your bile duct, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is the most common cause of hypothyroidism. And as a girl who takes thyroid pills every morning, that was interesting to me. Lupus, which is a pretty devastating autoimmune disease. Asthma. I have a sister who's an asthmatic. Inflammatory bowel disease, IBS, and all of that. Crohn's disease, again, another bowel disease, so it's not just celiac. Seizures, several forms of cancer, including bowel cancer, and Dr. Davis has said he thinks that that cancer of the digestive tract is very strongly linked to gluten. Something called ataxia, which is loss of balance and coordination. Indeed, it turns out that apparently roughly half of the patients that have otherwise unexplained ataxia, it turns out, test positive for celiac markers, also known as gluten sensitivity. And interestingly, there is something called gluten ataxia, which is a case of actual brain damage being done in the cerebellum by gluten sensitivity. It is progressive and irremediable brain damage. And the one that really scares me, dementia. Doesn't get any scarier than dementia. Again, gluten sensitivity can cause permanent brain damage. Gluten ataxia can progress to dementia. There are some links between Parkinson's disease and gluten as well. And of course, Parkinson's disease often results in dementia. But why this apparent increase in gluten sensitivity? Is this just a fad? Or, you know, after all, I mean, people have been eating some form of wheat for millennia. But dementia, we know, has only started accelerating just recently. There's a big upswing in dementia. Well, it turns out we are getting more wheat than we did, thanks to the big push for everyone to eat lots of healthy whole grains. There's also an increased awareness and research into the effects of gluten on the body. So no doubt that is part of why we're seeing this. But apparently that's not the whole problem. I was fascinated and floored by the opening chapters of Wheat Belly, where Dr. Davis explains in detail the evolution of the wheat plant through deliberate manipulation of breeding, also known, of course, as hybridization. It turns out that the wheat being grown today, the wheat that makes up the vast, vast majority of the wheat-based foods on the market today, is genetically completely different, not just from the original strains of wild grass that were domesticated 10,000 years ago, but from the wheat that was commonly grown as little as 50 years ago. It is quite simply a different plant than it was. It is different from the wheat your grandparents ate, and it has never been demonstrated to be safe for human consumption. Now, ancient wheat, the two strains that were originally, you know, what became wheat are called einkorn and emmer wheat, and then somewhere along the line, spelt got bred in too. Einkorn and emmer were not particularly safe for human consumption to begin with. You know, even as they were in their early unchanged state. We know that when our ancestors went from hunting and gathering to farming, their stature dropped, their lifespans shortened, their teeth rotted, and interestingly, their pelvises got smaller. Obviously, if your pelvis had already developed, it didn't shrink. But as generations went on eating grains, pelvis sizes got smaller, causing problems with childbearing. And this calls to mind the line from Genesis, the curse on Adam and Eve, that Eve's pain in childbearing will be greatly multiplied. We know that when hunter-gatherers became farmers, their pain in childbearing was indeed greatly multiplied. Diabetes also apparently started with wheat agriculture as well. But with all the hybridization that's gone on, things have changed. Turns out that unlike you or I, who only have genes that our moms and dads passed on to us, you know how it is. You got the blue-eye genes, you got the brown-eye genes, you know the drill. When you hybridize wheat, you actually come up with genes that were not present in either of the parent species. Specifically, you get roughly 5% novel, unique genes. And the genes that control gluten are particularly likely to undergo structural change. Now, you multiply that 5% by the tens of thousands of crossbreedings that have taken place to achieve the so-called Green Revolution high-yield semi-dwarf wheat that now dominates agriculture, and you have a product that has more gluten and more potentially sensitizing gluten proteins than has ever existed. This stuff has been great for agriculture's bottom line. Wheat yields per acre have increased dramatically. It's just that it's potentially far more toxic than wheat originally was. Details. Please note here, by the way, that we are not talking about genetic modification. We are simply talking about hybridizing, crossbreeding. Buying non-GMO wheat products is no protection. Dr. Davis did, however, experiment with einkorn and emmer. It is being grown again for the health food market, these primitive strains of wheat. And he found that he did not react to bread made from einkorn and emmer nearly as badly as he does to modern wheat. It didn't jack his blood sugar around nearly as badly. It did raise his blood sugar, but nowhere near as high as modern wheat. And he didn't wind up, you know, achy all over and logy for a day and whatever. Note as well that it doesn't matter whether the wheat product is refined or whole grain. It doesn't matter if it's Krispy Kreme donut or a bowl of whole wheat noodles from the health food store. It makes no difference. It all contains gluten. It's kind of like asking whether a recovering alcoholic would do better to drink a mudslide or a glass of red wine. Doesn't matter. It's all got alcohol. Well, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's refined or not. Doesn't matter whether it's GMO or not. It all has gluten. So, anyway, that's it for me. Excuse me. I have, over the last year and a half or so, largely dropped the low-carb tortillas and the low-carb bread from my diet just out of a suspicion that gluten wasn't a great idea. But I have, you know, occasionally had them. I last had a low-carb tortilla back in February. I was working on a recipe that seemed to call for them, and I had a couple and was hungover for a day. And that was the last time I had any low-carb breadstuffs at all. As far as I'm concerned, they're out of my diet forever. They're gone. I'm not eating wheat anymore. I will not be creating any more recipes with wheat germ or wheat bran. I will certainly not be using Vital Wheat gluten anymore. I think I will go back and rewrite some of my recipes that did have some of those wheat products to eliminate them, and especially to eliminate that Vital Wheat gluten. Now, I suspect this will not work with the yeast breads. I may have to just give up on yeast breads. I don't know. But quick breads, cookies, things like that should not be a big problem. I will not be using any low-carb specialty products that include gluten or wheat. I'm done. I'm even starting to read the labels on things that you wouldn't think of as having wheat in them. I've discovered that the multiple vitamins I've been taking for years and years do have some wheat in them. I'm going to be changing my brand of vitamins. I have discovered, quite sadly, that apparently Reese's sugar-free peanut butter cups have some gluten in them. I'm not certain about that. I will call the Reese's people and ask. But until I know for sure, I'm not eating those anymore. I'm just done. Well, whether you choose to give up low-carb bread and tortillas and things like that is, of course, up to you. If you have hinky blood sugar and you want to eat this sort of thing, it does seem to me that the low-carb version of these products is better than the high-carb version. You may be getting the toxic gluten, but at least you're not spiking your blood sugar. I do believe that there is a role for what are often called bridge foods, low-carb substitutes that help people get through what is, after all, a big damn change. But I do hope that if you choose to use bridge foods that contain wheat or wheat products, that you will keep it in the back of your mind that these are not foods to rely on, and they're not foods to really think about as long term. They're a crutch, to be used like a crutch until you can lay them down and walk without them. Now, you may find the idea of giving up all wheat products really daunting right now, and maybe you never will. I mean, that's, again, that's up to you. I'm information. I am certainly not enforcement. It is important that you realize that Dr. Davis also lays out excellent evidence for wheat being physically addictive and mind-altering. Interesting stuff. And remember, you know, we have the schizophrenia, we have the dementia, but physically addictive, mind-altering, makes people crave it. And it triggers the same sensors in the brain, he says, as opiates. In fact, the same drugs that can be used to block cravings for opiate drugs can also block wheat cravings, he says. I told you this book was full of fascinating information. This addictiveness of wheat is apparently part of that endless hunger that is caused by our high-carb diets. I had thought it was all due to the blood sugar fluctuations, but it turns out that it's not just the blood sugar. We've also all been a bunch of gluten junkies, as well as sugar junkies, with the opiate-like properties of gluten driving our cravings for another fix. Well, I doubt you can get your doctor to prescribe naltrexone or another opiate antagonist drug to help you go gluten-free. Doesn't seem likely. So like addicts of every stripe, if you want to quit, you're going to have to go cold turkey and just endure a few uncomfortable days. And by the way, some people, I guess, go through withdrawal and some people don't, just like some people go through the Atkins flu and some people don't. I'm not saying you have to do this. I'm not saying that if you plan to do it, you know, how soon you need to do it. I do want you to know that if you've got that little voice in the back of your head saying, never eat bread again, I just want you to listen to that voice and know that it's no different from the voice that says to other people, never smoke another cigarette, or never take another painkiller, or never have another drink. It's all the same voice. But if you do have any of the problems that are potentially linked to gluten, and particularly the devastating ones, I have recognized that one of my family members has ataxia that no one seems to be able to diagnose, and I've told him he needs to go gluten-free and, you know, at least find out what happens. And by the way, I did not list all of the gluten-linked health problems. You really need to read the book, guys. You really, really need to read this book. But if you do have any of the really serious problems that seem to be linked to gluten, you owe it to yourself to skip the bridge foods and go gluten-free. And, you know, try it for 6 weeks, and if you don't feel better, what the hell? Nothing lost. Do not, however, start eating a bunch of processed, purchased gluten-free breads and crackers and pasta and cereal and all that stuff. Why not? Because it's still loaded with carbs. That's why not, and carbs are still not your friend. Generally, the gluten-free stuff is made with rice flour, potato starch, corn starch, tapioca, other carby stuff like that. It's gluten-free, but it will still cause big, nasty blood sugar swings and the health problems and the obesity that come with them. So, back off. Okay, now that I've scared the bejesus out of you, let me assure you that despite the information in it, Wheat Belly is not a grim read at all. It is far from a grim read. Wheat Belly is fascinating, entertaining. Dr. Davis is a very lively writer. He is often funny. I really found the book very entertaining to read. The information itself, however, is deeply sobering. And not one of you can afford to miss it. Read Wheat Belly. Give it to your doctor. Get your family members to read it. This is important stuff. Okay, let's move on to something a tad less worrisome and distressing, shall we? Let us consider the matter of reality. What is reality? I hear all the Fire Sign Theater fans going, what is reality? Let's start with a quote from Alice in Wonderland. When I use a word, Humpty Dumpty said in a rather scornful tone. It means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. Well, it has long intrigued me how various words are used to denigrate our way of eating, and it's all a matter of how the person using them chooses to define the word. Over and over, I've heard, for instance, the word moderation. People are endlessly saying to me, I believe in moderation in all things. My response is, sure, so do I. Now define moderate. Of course, what they mean is that their consumption of sugar or whatever carby stuff is moderate, while my refusal to eat carby junk food is immoderate. By the way, you'll note that for some reason, no one uses this reasoning on recovering alcoholics. Oh, you should be able to just, you know, drink moderately, just have a drink now and then. Nobody says that. Nobody says it to people who are quitting smoking. You know, nobody says, oh, well, you should just be able to have 2 or 3 cigarettes on the weekend. Why is that? You know, don't you leave in moderation in all things? another word I hear is fun. In many people's minds, fun is synonymous with consuming junk food or consuming sugar. I've had people actually say to me, well, don't you have any fun anymore? Yeah. Lots. It's just not fun that involves eating sugar. But the one I want to talk about today is real, the word real. And to tell you where I'm coming from, I'm going to flash back a couple of years. Every autumn, that nice boy I married and I go to a local fundraising banquet. And a few years back, a perfect example of this use of the word real that I'm talking about came up at this banquet. I was talking to some of the folks at my table, and if I recall correctly, I said, somebody offered to get me a piece of cake, and I said, no thanks, I didn't want any cake, I didn't eat sugar or flour. And of course, I got the usual, oh, I could never give up sugar, because you always hear that. And, you know, everybody at the table was like, oh, I could never give up sugar. And I replied that since I could make a great batch of cookies or cake without sugar or flour, I really didn't have a problem with giving up the sugar and flour laden versions. Well, this was when the predictable happened. Someone said, oh, well, I'd just rather have the real thing less often. Is it unkind of me to mention that the woman who said this was seriously overweight, and I might add a vegetarian? So far as I can tell, when used this way, real is defined only as the version I am used to. Nothing more, nothing less. Yet there was no doubt in my mind from this woman's tone and her scowl that she considered her judgment of my low-carb baked goods as not real to be a very serious criticism. I wondered how she'd feel if facing a pot of meatless chili or a garden burger or a slice of tofurkey, I had said, oh, no, thanks, I'd rather have the real thing. You know, what the heck is real? Okay, I will admit that Splenda is not real for values of real that mean naturally occurring. Of course, a fair number of natural sweeteners don't actually occur in nature either. The only seriously concentrated sugar that I am aware of that occurs naturally is honey. Table sugar is, of course, a seriously refined food. In fact, in chemistry class, my professor used sugar as an example of a highly purified compound. Nothing natural about it. Sure doesn't occur that way in the sugarcane and in the real world. Maple syrup is less refined, but it is concentrated to 40 times the sugar content of the sap that comes out of the maple tree. Agave nectar, I have to tell you, is no more real than high fructose corn syrup. Being made in much the same way. In other words, what they do is they take a more complex carbohydrate and they use enzymes to break it down into the component fructose, which is not particularly good for you, I might add. And I have recently discovered that my local health food store is carrying organic corn syrup. I wonder if that's real, too. And, of course, Some of the other sweeteners we use, xylitol, erythritol, inulin, fructooligosaccharides, are as real as sugar is, at least, you know, if we're going for values of real that mean occurs in nature. Stevia, of course, occurs in nature. But how about the rest of the ingredients in my cookies or cakes? We have butter and eggs, baking powder or soda, vanilla, chocolate or, cocoa powder, spices. All of these are exactly the same ingredients that you would use in the real variety. So the other big swap in my baked goods is for the flour. In the place of the flour, I usually use nut meal and vanilla whey protein powder. How are nut meal and vanilla whey protein powder not real? I would venture that almond meal is more real than white flour, since it's simply shelled almonds that have been ground up into powder and has not been either refined or enriched. And furthermore, almond meal is arguably part of the evolutionary human diet, since almonds are indeed edible raw, while, of course, wheat is toxic when eaten raw and has been so heavily hybridized, as we mentioned, over the past century or so, that it's dramatically genetically different from the wheat that our grandparents knew. So how is that more real than my almond meal? I don't know why vanilla whey protein wouldn't be at least as real as flour. And, you know, certainly whey occurs in nature. And certainly both almond meal, or for that matter, hazelnut meal, which I also use, and vanilla whey protein powder have a whole lot more flavor than flour, because white flour has exactly zero flavor. But apparently my baked goods aren't real because they're not what the general public is accustomed to. They're not what this disapproving woman had grown up on. I'm sure that the same is true of my hash browns, since they're made of those unreal turnips or rutabaga instead of those super, super real potatoes. But the shirataki noodles I eat can't possibly be real because they're made of those crazy, unreal synthetic konjac roots instead of from that very, very real enriched white flour we were talking about. And of course, my pureed cauliflower, that's synthetic as can possibly be, instead of course, the super real mashed potatoes. My cauliflower must have come out of a lab. I have a feeling a lot of these people would even consider instant mashed potatoes to be real compared to my pureed fresh cauliflower. This whole concept gets even odder when you think of processed packaged stuff. Now, I'm no fan of soda, whether it's sugary or diet or even the new all-natural diet soda, the Zevia. But I confess that I smirk a little bit when people say about diet soda in scornful tones, "Oh, I only drink the real stuff." Yeah, because there's a Coca-Cola spring out there where the little woodland elves bottle the real thing. I've heard people refer, of course, to real ketchup as opposed to no sugar added ketchup. That real ketchup is made with lots and lots of real corn syrup. And real barbecue sauce instead of the stuff I make, which again has no real corn syrup in it. And I bet a fair sum that somewhere out there, there's a person who would tell you that Oreos and Chips Ahoy are real cookies and my homemade low-carb ones are somehow not real. Flashing back to that real cake that I didn't care to eat, I find it very hard to imagine that it was made from scratch, without a mix and with no artificial ingredients, and using all butter in the frosting instead of, say, margarine or a vegetable shortening. We're talking cake for a catered banquet for something like 300-400 people. And I'm damn certain that the color in that frosting did not come from beets and blueberries. The use of the word real, in some ways, it seems to me, mirrors and is the flip side of the common refrain that we should eat whole foods, coming from people who define whole foods as boneless, skinless chicken, lean muscle meats, and fat-free dairy. It's subtle code for I'm right and you're wrong. That's what it is. Well, we here in the world of low carb have our own definition of real, thank you. We eat real meat and eggs and cheese and even real organ meats and real fat. We eat nuts and seeds. We eat butter and coconut oil and olive oil and lard and bacon grease. I do think we should keep processed low-carb product, even processed low-carb gluten-free products, to a minimum in preference for, dare I say it, real food, which in this case we're going to define as stuff you would recognize in its raw form. I'm pretty sure that that couldn't be said of a garden burger. On the other hand, I have all the ingredients that go into Grace Island cheese crisps in my kitchen. You know, and I'm pretty sure you've got most of them too. And by the way, if you haven't tried the Grace Island cheese crisps, folks, CarbSmart carries them and they're amazing. And oh dear, I forgot to credit CarbSmart at the beginning of this podcast. This show is brought to you by our friends at CarbSmart, your smart choice for a low carb lifestyle. But they do have the Grace Island cheese crisps and they are made of all, yes, real ingredients. Anyway, the next time someone scornfully dismisses your low-carb alternative as not being the real thing, just reply, define real. Or better yet, just ignore them. Anyway, that's it for this week. We will keep the low-carb voices question going. And the question is still, what's the best low-carb lunchbox food? Especially interested in ideas for kids. And given this week's podcast, ideas for kids that don't involve any wheat products, no low-carb tortillas or stuff like that. If you've got some ideas to share or a question or a recipe or an idea for a low-carb treat or really anything you want to share with the low-carb community, call 412-385-DANA. That's 412-385-3262. And let us know. If you have any friends that you think might like the show, please steer them to the show page at danaslowcarbforlife.com. And if you like the show, how about leaving us a review at iTunes? We would love that. Don't forget to check out the blog at holdthetoast.com and join my Facebook fan page at Dana Carpenter's Hold the Toast Press. It's a lot of fun there. We got a great group of people. We got all sorts of low-carb conversation going on. So do sign up for that. I haven't checked, but it's getting close enough to pub date that I'm guessing you could pre-register for 300 low-carb slow cooker recipes at Amazon.com. In fact, I will check after I finish recording this, and if indeed you can pre-order it now, I will have Kevin, the producer, throw that link up on the show page, along with, of course, a link for Wheat Belly. If you've got 315-minute low-carb recipes and you like it, please go review it at Amazon.com. And that's it for this week. Remember, till next week, stay low-carb for life.
This is Dana Carpenter saying thanks for listening. If you like today's show, please leave a review at the iTunes store. You can always leave questions and comments at 412-385-DANA or write us at feedback@danaslowcarbforlife.com. Complete show notes, please visit our site at www.danaslowcarbforlife.com and don't forget to visit the blog at holdthetoast.com. Special thanks to Disc of Light Media and our sponsor, CarbSmart.com.